Hi everyone, and welcome to the Real World Behavioural Science podcast, where we look at how behavioural and social sciences are being used in the real world to help change the public's health for good. My name is Stu King, and I'm here with Dr. Tiago Motella with another great show for you. Tiago, how are you?
Hi Stu, I'm very good. It's Christmas next week, so I'm very excited about that. I love Christmas.
It is. Yeah, I love Christmas too, actually. And you're going back to Portugal. For all those that don't know, Tiago claims to be Portuguese. You're going to Portugal, are you? I've got inverted commas up as I do that air quote.
Sim. That's yes for Portugal.
Now, anyone who's Portuguese who might be listening, confirm. Did that sound authentic? Sure. Did that sound authentic or not? Yes, we both love Christmas, and we did promise everybody that we would have a Christmas extravaganza, and by God, have we got one. This is a long one, guys. Yes. Give yourself some time. This is a feature length, hour and 50 minute.
It is.
But it is well worth it, if not a little bit strange. But before we do anything,
yes,
I want to stop us, because we have something that we must promote, and that is the BSPHN conference.
Indeed.
You went last year, didn't you? I actually couldn't go last year because I had COVID, but you went last year, didn't
I
you? How did you find it?
Well, we were meant to go together. You did message me on the morning of the day saying you had COVID. So it was really good. It was really good. I knew quite a lot of people there, even people we work with in public health, different commissioners, different researchers. It was really good. The audience was great and the talks were incredible.
Yeah, and they're going to be excellent this year as well. We were going to be recording actually some of the show from there, weren't we? I think we'll probably do the same thing this year. So we'll be there recording some bits and bobs for the show. But the speakers that we've got at this upcoming conference are incredible. Yeah. Your task is to go and check them out. It's at bsphn.org.uk. Look at the black bar at the top. They've hidden the join bar or the buy now bar. But go and find the black bar at the top showing the details of the conference, or just Google BSPHN conference 2024 and book yourself a place. T, why don't you tell them who's speaking and why they should sign up?
So they should sign up because of who's speaking, I would say, and because the atmosphere is great. But in terms of who we are going to have, we're going to have some amazing speakers. So Sue Cumming, who's the head of Behaviour Insight and Change in Public Health Liverpool, Professor Matt Ashton, Director of Public Health, Liverpool City Council, Ashley Gold, Programme Director, Behaviour Science Unit, Public Health Wales, and Sir Michael Marmot, Professor of Epidemiology at University College London, Director of UCL Institute of Health Equity, and past President of the World Medical Association, and the author of our favourite.
Very famous studies.
Very famous studies. The Social Determinants of Health Model in 2010, which we use pretty much on a daily basis in the work.
For sure, that has pretty much changed public health.
Yeah.
And honestly, this is a really amazing list. We will actually be interviewing Ash Gold as well. We've been trying to get him on the show for a while. So I think a revival of that effort will ensue in the new year, so we will have him on. But this is an amazing group, the great talks, the networking opportunities at the conference are awesome. You will meet like-minded people. If you listen to this show, there will be people like you there, I guarantee it. So please do sign up.
Can I just say, Stu, I just want to say, if there's not enough reason to go, the food is quite good. I didn't go last year, and that was something that people were talking about, which is, it was great food.
So all of this takes place in Liverpool John Moores University on Tuesday the 20th of February. You can get your tickets now. Early bird price is still available. So get online, bsphn.org.uk, and go and get yourself some tickets now. But now I want to stop talking about that and move on to the show, introduce the guest that we have. So we've been waiting a long time for this one.
A very long time.
I'm gonna say that this show is wonderfully crazy, because you will probably in sort of cutting it together and that as well. I've reaffirmed that view, because when you know we can barely get a question. You actually do get a couple of questions in, but I really struggle to get questions into this one. The good thing about Rory is he just has. And how did you describe him before?
I think to me was super funny, super informative, but enjoyably mad, I think was the way I would put this. There were phone interruptions, noises, distractions, but I personally had a great time. I had a lot of fun, and I think it's a great episode.
It is funny, and I do love Rory's sort of voice and the way he sort of interjects and just goes off on one. In everything he says, there's a tangent to something else. Yeah. And I think you'll see that in this. But let's do a brief introduction and then get on to the show. So Rory Sutherland joined Ogilvy and Mathers as a graduate trainee planner in 1988, having been inspired to join the advertising industry by British TV advertising of the 80s. He worked briefly in account management before switching to copywriting and became the creative director in 2001. From 2008 to 2012, he served as president of the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising. And in 2012, Rory founded the behavioral science practice within the Ogilvy Group, whose goal is to develop marketing techniques inspired by the fields of psychology and economics, rather than shape customers' desires through conventional advertising. I personally talk about this all the time. You will know this if you're a regular listener. I love his book, Alchemy. So in his book, Alchemy, The Power of Ideas That Don't Make Sense, Rory argues that great marketing ideas are often built around a core that is profoundly irrational. Mm. Now, that is what this show is all about.
Yes.
So before we keep going on about the book and stuff, let's get straight to the show and we'll go and introduce Rory.
Let's do it.
Okay, welcome Rory Sutherland.
Hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great stuff. Thanks, Rory. Rory, we've been looking forward to this a lot. I've seen you on different other shows, looked at, you know, all of the different nudge stocks, lots of different talks and things that you've been at over the years. And so we're really excited to have you here. Why don't you start by just telling us a little bit about your journey to where you are now and what it is you actually do now at Ogilvy?
Well, I was a classics graduate. I trained as a teacher, funnily enough. I've kind of ended up accidentally as a kind of teacher, I suppose. I had a kind of panic attack during my teacher training because I realised if I went from a school to a university and then spent the rest of my life in a school, I realised it was the opposite of teach first. I thought I might want to teach later in life, but I don't want to do this immediately. Yeah. And being honest, funnily enough, a rare example of a careers teacher getting it right, I did do some sort of psychometric test when I was about 14, and the job that came up second, I think, after barrister or something, was advertising. And also, bear in mind...
They do
occasionally work. And in the late 80s, it's also, you know, let's be honest about advertising, it's a job which actually is in the middle of that Venn diagram overlap between interesting and tolerably remunerative. You know, I didn't want to go into banking or finance or accountancy, but equally I didn't want to become a kind of go into contemporary dance either or choreography. Okay,
that would have been interesting.
And so it would have been, You see a very different person, I suspect. I then applied and I had various first and second interviews with ad agencies, and through an extraordinary lucky fluke, I got a job at what was then called Ogilvy and Mather Direct, which is kind of the direct marketing or direct response advertising, as it was called, wing of the giant Ogilvy and Mather agency, as then was. Mm-hmm. And it was lucky in two ways, one of which is that it effectively spurred my interest in what subsequently became known as behavioural economics or behavioural science, or even decision science. Because it was the part of advertising where you could test and measure, because you had coupons sent in from press ads, you had responses to direct mail, you had responses to telephone calls, etc. And you could actually tweak the message and then evaluate. Generally, it was a very well-funded social science experiment with large numbers of people. You know, typically, you know, with direct mail, it might be 50,000 people would be a test cell. Okay, if you're working for BT. And very rapidly, you discovered things which were very, very surprising, which ran completely counter to the rational or rather post-rationalized assumptions about how people should think, decide and act.
Yeah.
And was that known, actually, Rory, was that known then? Were they expecting these weird results or was this sort of the start of that?
To be honest, behavioral science, if you go back far enough, and certainly behavioral economics, you could certainly make a case that Adam Smith was a behavioral economist and indeed a behavioral scientist. Yeah. I mean, he wrote two books. The other book is really a treatise about psychology and human interaction. It's philosophical, not economic. as is largely the wealth of nations, I would argue. It's his follow. It's a bit like Marx. I mean, the guy was very, very clever, but his followers distilled what he wrote down to a completely grotesque oversimplification, you know. And but Aesop, I always say, is the first behavioural scientist. You could argue that, you know, those are, what is it, 7th century BC. You know, the little Aesop's fables quite often have, you know, behavioural science lessons. Dog in the manger, for example. Sour grapes, okay? All of those little Aesop's fables refer to, not all of them, but most of them, refer to little quirks of human psychology.
Yeah.
And then Jesus was a behavioural... Jesus
your,
was...
Your classics. Your classics knowledge is probably
better. I was going to say.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
I mean, Jesus... Were you about to say that Jesus, yeah.
Jesus was definitely, not many things, but he was also undoubtedly interested in behavioural science because things like,
I like
the parable of the vineyard, the lost sheep, of course, loss aversion, okay?
Okay. Loss.
The parable of the lost sheep is absolutely about, you know, loss aversion, okay?
Yeah.
And so what I realised was there's this whole dimension to human perception and action, okay? Perception, feeling and action, some of it unconscious, which is not really accounted for in any of the conventional models. And I thought, well, that's, which is also true of medicine, by the way, just to keep your medical audience interested. Okay. I mean, it always fascinates me. And I had a conversation, I'll tell you a very funny story. But anyway, the other reason, by the way, the other reason why I was very lucky going to Ogilvy and made the direct response was that at the time and subsequently, but particularly at the time, it was home to an extraordinarily interesting group of totally disparate but almost universally fascinating people. And, you know, Steve Harrison, Drayton Bird, people like David Nobe. A lot of these people, Andy Greenaway, went on to become very famous in advertising. It was a bit like, you know, if you'd worked at Saatchi's at a certain time, you know, you would have been hanging out with people who subsequently became, you know, David Putnam and Lord Putnam and so on. There was just this particular kind of agglomeration of people, which was so, you know, I'd kind of wanted to get into advertising, and actually, you know, direct response was considered, you know, a little bit of a second best option, but it turned out to be the luckiest thing that ever happened to me, because it got me fascinated in the whole psychology of decision making and behavior with real evidence, okay, rather than just supposition or assertion. And secondly, because the people there were just almost, you know, almost to a man and woman, absolutely fascinating. You learned a huge amount. It was an unbelievably time of huge discussion, experimentation and so forth. And so that also placed me in a very good place. And luckily, because I was there, I was able to become a copywriter. Obviously, if you're hired as a graduate trainee, it tends to be assumed that you become an account man. And I very rapidly realised I wanted to be a copywriter. And it was the kind of environment where that change could happen. Maybe a lot more difficult now than then. I also had the lucky thing, which is to tell the story of my hiring, which I always think is a lesson in choice architecture. I think if they'd had one job, there wasn't a chance I would have got that job. But they had four, and they had three very good candidates already, I think. I think I was the fourth pick, the last draft pick, if I'm being honest. I've heard stories to that effect. And they had three extremely sound candidates who were great people who went on to do amazing things. And they kind of were a bit undecided because they had four jobs. And they, one of them, I think it might have been Drayton Bird or it might have been someone else, said, why don't we just take a punt on the weirdo? You know,
so, you know, were you the oddball?
And actually, it suddenly taught me a lesson I learned much later, which is that one way to encourage diversity is to hire people in groups. Because when you only have one job, you tend to stick cleave very close to the expected norm. And you can't afford to take a risk, because if your one hire turns out bad, it's a problem. You made a bad decision. Whereas if you reframe your decision, which is we're hiring 10 people and we're only expecting six of them to work out, you can go much broader. And that would apply to ethnicity, gender, but it would also apply perhaps a more important part of diversity still, which is kind of cognitive diversity.
Yeah.
And I was undoubtedly, you know, a bit of an outlier, which is why, you know, I got to second interviews at various agencies, but they basically put me in the sort of too difficult pile. And all credit to probably Drayton Bird, I would guess, who's still active, and he's the kind of doyen of British direct marketing, deservedly so, and one of the sort of three or four people I'd place as the greatest influence on my life. You know, he basically said, look, let's just go a bit wide here. You know, we don't need four safe hires. We want four interesting hires. And if two of them don't work out, as it happened, all four did. I mean, you know, all credit to them.
Yeah.
Is this something, have you always been the creative in, even when you were talking about the teaching days, have you always had that side of your brain?
I've always been highly curious. That's probably fair. And I think curiosity is the necessary precondition for creativity. Yeah. You know, I don't know of, you know, David Ogilvy described a good copywriter as someone who's an extensive browser in all kinds of fields. And when I read that kind of description, I thought that's kind of me, really.
That's me.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I also have this strange thing, which is I have a mixture, which is also very well suited to direct marketing, which is I did maths and further maths A level. Okay.
Right. Okay.
And so my brother's actually a cosmologist and astrophysicist. And so quite a large part of my family were scientists. And so what I liked about direct response... So my father was an entrepreneur. My mum was mostly a housewife, but actually part of my father's, a very integral part of my father's business, which involved everything from sort of property development to property rental to running a water bus on the Brecon and Abergavenny Canal to, you know, it was effectively, you know, obviously, it goes without saying. But he was effectively a kind of plural. He was plural before the term existed and, you know, had various sort of business. He was an entrepreneur. Which is a great background. It's a great background to grow up in as well, because I always say that actually, you know, one quality Rishi Sunak possesses is that if you, I think his mother was a pharmacist. Now, if you grow up in a shop, it's a free MBA, basically. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody who grows up in a shop or a family business, that's custom actually service. More valuable than a Harvard MBA, because you get to actually appreciate the business in its holistic entirety, not in its stupid individualized separated parts, not in its silos. You actually see a business in microcosm. And I think, you know, I think that explains, by the way, partly why people from the sort of what you might call the, you know, an ethnic groups which have traditionally been into shopkeeping or running restaurants go on to become disproportionately successful in business, because you actually started learning when you were 12.
Yeah, for sure.
True.
It's a bit like that phrase in, you know, that phrase in Peep Show, you know, you've got to get yourself a van. Having a van's like having an MBA, but you've also got a van. I think that's Super Hans in Peep Show. And there, you know, there's having that background was really interesting, because the sort of what you might call the mentality of the entrepreneur is fundamentally opportunistic, whereas the mentality of the business person, as business becomes more and more bureaucratic, is increasingly that of the self-justification. It's the cult of self-justification.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether my decision turns out well, so long as I can defend it as a good decision. And entrepreneurs aren't like that at all. Entrepreneurs will act on anecdote, they'll act on hunch, they'll act on instinct. They'll make decisions where all the actual evidence is against them, in a spirit of actually kind of insane optimism, if you look at the overall figures for restaurants that succeed. But at the same time, sometimes they're right. And when they're unexpectedly right, being unexpectedly right is 10 times more valuable than being predictably right.
Yeah.
In commercial terms.
I know what you mean.
So there, there's this restaurant, I told this story in the last podcast, there's this restaurant in Sevenoaks, and every restaurant that opened at this location failed. You had to park on the hill. It was difficult to park. Mm. You ended up parking downhill from the restaurant, which meant you had to walk uphill to get your meal. They were kind of fancy French restaurants. One of them was actually called the House on the Hill, funnily enough. Uh-huh. And that failed, as had the previous five restaurants all failed. And the guy who ran the kebab shop decides to buy it and open up, I think, a posh Turkish restaurant. I was going, oh, please don't do that. Every restaurant's failed. Why are you doing that? Place is an uproarious success, okay? And it's like that because, you know, actually the previous evidence, you change one element of the equation, okay? If you look at all the elements of the equation, you go, this is completely the wrong location to open a restaurant. But if you change one element of the equation, all the rules change. It's like Red Bull, right? Red Bull costs a fortune, comes in a tiny can and tastes disgusting. Those are not the rules you'd follow when selling a carbonated drink. Except when you make it a placebo stroke pharmaceutical product. In other words, you know, the promise of Red Bull is psychotropic or pharmacological
energy and wings
and mental acuity or whatever it may be. Okay, now when you make something medicinal, all the rules change. You want it to be expensive. You want it to taste weird because medicine is supposed to taste weird. Okay. And you want it to come in a small can because it suggests a measured dose. You know, we can't give you a full-size can of this stuff because you go dalali. That's how potent this stuff is. We've got it. It's like those ginger shots, right? The ginger shots work because they're fucking tiny. Right? You go, fucking hell, that must be pretty, that must be pretty bloody potent.
Yeah, that's true. I see, I would be worried about the Red Bull stuff, but I know I've heard you say this loads of times elsewhere, so we're not in any trouble from that. That's not a problem.
They researched it, and the research told them I would not drink this drink. Synatogen, which was a tonic wine, the last ingredient they added, do you remember it? It was highly sweet wine.
Vitamins.
Well, I think the origin of tonic wine was basically for people who are borderline alcoholic, or I may be doing a huge injustice there. But there are a lot of religious groups who can't drink alcohol but are allowed it for medicinal purposes. So if you sell a wine that's medicinal, you're kind of allowed to drink it because it's it's just for my stomach's sake. You know, have a little wine for your stomach's sake, as Paul said, I think, okay? Now, interestingly, I think the last ingredient they add is something that tastes a bit weird. And the whole reason is if it tastes too nice, people don't believe it's good for them. Okay. So this will bring me on later on to the placebo effect, which I think is one of the most interesting things about reductionist science, which is reductionist science tries to remove the placebo effect from the equation to prove the effect of the medicine individually in isolation from all other factors. But if you're a systems thinker, you should be trying to maximize the combinatory effect of both the medicine and pharmacological effect, along with the psychological effect, and indeed the belief in its efficacy.
See, this is something I want to ask about.
And by the way, I always thought this was a weird idea, and then I discovered a bunch of other people who thought the same thing, including at a dinner recently, Sir Patrick Vallance, would you believe, who also agreed that we should be saying, how do we maximise pharmacological and psychological factors in attaining some medical result, rather than saying the placebo effect's bad, let's try and strip this out of the equation. Far more research should go on into how you make a really effective placebo, and then it should be used in combination with the drug. Now,
is it because... To be seen as science, you need to have that logical, reasonable explanation. Otherwise, it's not really science. And when it comes to stuff like that...
Well, science is also... In order to prove something, you have to disentangle it from everything else, which means what you're trying to prove is the standalone effect. But what you're trying to maximise, that's what gets you approved by NICE or whatever it is, okay?
Yeah.
What you're trying to maximise is the overall efficacy, which also includes factors not only like the placebo effect, but also adherence. Okay, will people go on doing this? Now, I've lost about 2 stone in a period of about a month with a combination of Ozempic, also known as semaglutide, which a friendly doctor brings in from France occasionally, and metformin, and also a transformative technology, which I'd love to talk about, which is the CPAP machine, because I had sleep apnea.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is changing the quality of your sleep fundamentally changes your appetites. Alongside now what a scientist would want to do is to say, how do we separate what part in this is played by the semaglutide, what part of this is the metformin, and what part of this is the CPAP machine? Okay, that's what a scientist is wanting to do, because they want to actually isolate. But what if the effects are combinatorial? Now, the French always over prescribe. Okay, if you go to France and you say, ooh, I've got a bit of a gammy knee, they'll give you like 5 suppositories, a thing to put around your knee. They'll send you on a course of physiotherapy, right? I mean, you know, and then, you know, and then you get confused and start swallowing the bloody things you're supposed to put up your bum, okay? But, okay.
Is this from experience, Rory, you're talking
about? My wife's experience, where she once was prescribed a load of things for flu by a French doctor, went to a British doctor and said, I've been given all these 3 things to take by the French doctor, and the British doctor just threw them all in the bin, okay?
Right.
But here's the thing, right? It may be that only one... What I'm interested in, I don't care which of those things is working. What I care about is all 3 things in combination seem to work quite well. They seem to be a game changer. In fact, I haven't eaten today because I no longer have... Now, that could be the semaglutide. It could be the CPAP machine. Okay? Don't care, right? What I want to know is what 3 things in combination would most help me lose weight. I don't want to disentangle the 3 because the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Now, hold on. Actually, oh, it's got a phone ring.
Nice accompaniment to that.
I'll just, there we are. And it may well be that 1 + 1 + 1 = 5 in this situation. For fuck's sake. Sorry. Right. Sorry.
You know what I like about this intro, right, is the question, how did you get to where you are now and what are you doing now, has included Jesus.
Jesus. As a
Aesop. Aesop. Don't forget
Aesop. Aesop as well.
Covering all the bases.
Yeah, we've gone right back.
Now, oh, this is just ridiculous.
It's exactly what I imagined
it would
be.
Good. This is very good.
Hello.
The title Jesus was interested in behavior science.
Yeah, I like it. I think that could definitely be a quote that goes down into the show notes and the narrative. Oh dear. So I do want to try and get us to something.
Yeah.
to one of these questions at some point.
Yes.
Right. Sorry about that. I'm back in the
That's
world.
Absolutely okay. Fine.
No worries.
3, 2, 1. I'm back in the room. Some spammer. Right. Which explains the persistence.
Persistent spammer.
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. But the combinatorial effect, particularly now, maybe there isn't much of a multiplicative effect pharmacologically. Okay, maybe the combinatorial effect pharmacologically is small. The combinatorial effect in placebo terms might be massive because you think, right, I'm really blitzing it here.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. I'm really, you know, I've given it all I've got. Now I have a reason to believe that my circumstances have changed and I can therefore lose a lot of weight. Okay, so yeah. Maybe the French doctors are right in that the extra two drugs are actually, I mean, in some cases they could be, undoubtedly people are over-medicated in France, right? But in some cases, the fact that you're given 3 drugs for a hurty knee might actually massively improve the psychological belief that my knee is going to get better because I'm actually giving it all it's got and my doctor's, you know, really pulling out all the stops on this one, rather than the British approach, which is we're going to give you this one thing, okay?
Yeah.
So there may be a case where there's a combinatorial effect of drugs, perhaps, okay? So I don't care whether it's the metformin on its own or the CPAP machine on its own. And this is where I think this is a failure in the scientific method, that in trying to disentangle, okay, what's working, you may be turning your back on combinations of things where literally the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts.
See, to me, if you had enough...
So Patrick Vallance, it was really funny, by the way, because I turned up to give the Harvey oration at the Royal College of Physicians. And I, until about 2 days beforehand, I was kind of thinking, mental note, after dinner speech to a bunch of doctors, you know, I was preparing kind of knob gags. And then I suddenly had a look at the invitation list, and it was kind of Chris Whitty, Sir Patrick Vallance. And I thought, okay, I think I'm going to have to raise my game a bit here. Okay, right.
Please tell me there was a couple of knob gags.
had it been surgeons, of course, the knob gags would have been fine. But
right. Well, let me ask a question about.
I did have a good gag, which I've used several times.
Let's do the gag.
Steel, which is, I've given quite a few talks at the Royal College of Physicians because they rent it out for conferences. I've also given talks at the Royal College of General Practitioners, which is just down the road. And I assume that there's a little bit of rivalry between them. And I said that when I was giving a talk at the Royal College of General Practitioners, this is actually true, I couldn't find the building. And I thought, I could ring them up and ask for directions. And then I thought, no, they'll only just tell me to ring back at 8 o'clock the following morning.
That's a nice clean
gag. That's quite
a
good
gag.
Quite a good clean gag. Absolutely. Yeah.
Let me ask a question then, Rory, about the... Because I like the combinatorial thing, absolutely on board right now. But
by the way, maybe, what I need is metformin plus bloody, you know, thing and a personal trainer, right? Now, there's this kind of Anglo-Saxon efficiency thing, which comes from reductionist thinking, which is you pretend everything's a machine and you pretend that every part in the machine has a specific function, okay? And therefore, if you optimize one part, you optimize the whole. Now, biologists know that isn't true. That's a convenient myth that we pretend things are physics because the maths for biology is too complicated, okay? And so I think there's an Anglo-Saxon thing, which is we must prescribe the minimum possible thing. What's the most efficient way we can treat this thing? Whereas actually the French approach of actually not only will we do this, but we'll give you some weight loss counselling, okay? That may actually work, right? It's kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Let me
probe that a little bit, right? So because we do work in this environment and in health and well-being where I'm sure you're aware of whole systems approaches in various different places, but one of them is for obesity, say, for example.
Yeah.
And that says, you know, there's lots of prevention, there's treatment, there's surgical treatment as much as there is,
yes,
you know,
there's even, by the way, placebo surgery, which works for obesity, apparently.
Yeah, well,
if you operate on someone, claim you've given them a gastric band and don't, yeah, apparently they still lose weight, which is a bloody interesting discovery, let's be honest, right?
And the reverse is often true as well. Lots of people.
Well, I'll tell you a story about quitting smoking and the placebo effect, which is a lot of people. I quit smoking very successfully when I had kids.
Yeah.
Now, 70% of that is totally rational. It's that, you know, if you've got two slightly premature twins sitting in a cot, yeah, sitting there blasting Cohiba smoke over their sleeping form doesn't really feel right. Smoking in their presence just feels wrong. So you're going to quit to a large extent at home anyway. But a large part of it, not 50%, but some part of it, was I now have a narrative to explain why I quit. In other words, rather than I used to smoke, sure, but then I realised I was silly. We don't like realising we were silly. I used to smoke, then I realised I was silly, so I stopped smoking. And I've got a father-in-law who claims that he did smoke, but then he read some scientific paper and stopped. Or that, you know, he made a rant. No. That wasn't the reason at all, okay? Effectively, what we need is a reason to explain why we've changed our behaviour, which is why new products and new technologies, the CPAP machine, by the way, is bloody interesting, right? Because I said, look, this is, by the way, by courtesy of the Royal Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead and their sleep disruption centre or something, okay? And they, the people at St Thomas's just put me in for a sleep trial. They sent me some home tech. That measured my sleep. It said you have actually very interrupted sleep, you know, sort of per hour there were double digit numbers of interruptions. So I drove down to East Grinstead, lovely drive, and they fitted me out with a brand new, much smaller than the previous one, CPAP machine, which also is self-calibrating and also reports back a score on my sleep quality every night. So let's have a look at last night. Now, I said, actually, this thing is so transformative, I think you should consumerize it. I think you should just allow people to buy them. Mm-hmm. Because as an ad guy, you have to have them prescribed, I think. And that's because historically they needed to be calibrated. And I think now they're self-calibrating. Now, what apparently happens, by the way, you've gone weirdly green. You're no longer green. That's not a problem. Here we go. Let's have a look at my little Myer sleep score. Here we go. It should be somewhere here. I then spoke to a doctor who's also a sports doctor, and I said, why don't they just consumerize these? And he said, well, it's interesting you mention it, because he said athletes, he works with a lot of athletes, athletes actually get hold of kind of what you might call off-label CPAP machines, and they hack them. And the reason is, bluntly put, with a CPAP machine, it's a bit like, the way to describe it is a bit like 8 hours sleep for the price of six. So athletes are conscious of the fact that the quality of their sleep has a fairly major effect. And why isn't it giving me my score for last night?
No performance. That's an easy sell. 8 hours sleep.
For the price of six. That's my ad man approach to this. Okay. So you are a bit sleep deprived because you spend up too late looking at screens, you have to get up early in the morning. Okay. At the very least, if you only get 6 hours sleep, it's 6 hours of high quality sleep.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so my take on this was, look, this is kind of nuts. We should actually be... we should actually be making these available to the public, because I would argue that both in terms of weight loss and sleep quality, we should at least do an experiment where people are allowed to buy them, because it's a hell of a game changer.
It would also improve relationships, I think, as well.
Massively. The slight sexual downside partners. Is you go to sleep looking like Hannibal Lecter. So yeah, unless your wife's one of those serial killer fanatics. But the upside is the relationship quality, road accident quality through better quality sleep.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. There are enough things which we should be looking at here, I think, that it, maybe we're being silly actually demanding that these things are prescribed, because there would be a consumer market for them where the net effect is pretty beneficial.
Now, Rory, let me get to a question here, because I knew this would happen and I'm glad it is, but I also want to ask you a question. So I'm going to come back to the combinatorial thing, right? Because in whole systems thinking, for example, there's lots of things that we should be considering, at least if we're sort of thinking about the multitude of ways that we can impact people's health and well-being, for example, the physical environment, the social environment, you know, finances, all the different things that affect people's ability to sort of make.
But by the way, if you want me to just one final attack on the scientific method, I think the p-value.
Go for it.
The use of p-values in looking at the significance of something is the paper to read on that is by the economist Deirdre McCloskey. And her debate is that the use of p-values to determine what you might call significance is not a measure of significance. It's a measure of your ability to generalize confidently, okay? Which is not the same as significance, particularly when some treatments may work very well for some people and indeed possibly badly for others, okay? So the act of averaging involved in producing those p-values is probably responsible for promoting treatments which are actually dud and also killing off treatments which had real potential. So the scientific method, we tend to go, ooh, science, okay, because, you know, follow the science. Well, not necessarily, because maybe the method being deployed by the science, I mean, the whole 0.05 thing is totally arbitrary. That was one guy, a very, very brilliant statistician called Fisher, okay, who came up with this sort of 1 in 20. If 1 in 20 stands a chance, it's going to be good. Well, no, because the level of certitude you require entirely depends on what you plan to do with the information, what your next step is, and what the likely consequences are, right? A drug that might work really well but probably doesn't, okay, if you're giving it to someone who might otherwise die, will throw anything at it. So having this basis, okay, and similarly, the science got COVID wrong. It was totally slow on picking up it was airborne because two people got two measures, one of which was... Now, OK, I'll tell you a secret about this. They thought that anything in particles...
Is this from Patrick Vallance?
No. I'm not getting into this, OK. But there was some weird thing that effectively, below a certain number of microns, TB could spread because TB needs to infect the furthest parts of the lung in order for it to become contagious. And so they neglected the importance of particles above a certain size. Now, and they'd somehow got into the conclusion that particles above a certain size aren't airborne. Okay? Now, I don't want to be rude, but if more doctors smoked, okay, they'd actually know, right? If you smoke
a
cigarette...
We're endorsing here today.
We're not endorsing this, okay? But if just a few doctors were into the Marlboro Lights, they'd see that when you smoke a cigarette, massive smoke particles are enormous, right? They're way bigger than the kind of thing that's captured by a HEPA filter, all right? But they hang around in the air like crazy because air is kind of weirdly sticky. At the level of small particles, air is more like a fluid, if you're a small particle, than it is like a gas. Okay? And so you know, there were some pretty egregious mistakes made, I think. Not least the rejection of the lab leak hypothesis, which is still unconfirmed. Yeah, but I mean, it was rejected.
There's a lot of controversy coming out here.
Vastly too hastily. And I'm just sitting there, I'm just some guy working at an ad agency, and I'm going... I'm not really comfortable with this. I think scientists are partly reluctant to blame the lab leak hypothesis because then the result of COVID is like a score draw, that scientists have done a wonderful job of curing a disease which they themselves created. Okay.
Yeah.
Because no one else is going to collect batshit from a horrible cave and transport it 1,000 miles to a place in the middle of a densely populated city, right? No one's going to do that for the lols, are they? It's only scientists who think that's a good idea, right? You know, the locals around those caves would have had some kind of... They would have said the caves are unholy or they're cursed or they're haunted or something, right? And they go, don't go in the batshit-infested caves, right? Now, that's an irrational reason driving a perfectly rational behaviour. And we need to understand this, that quite a lot of things that are enshrined in religion look irrational to us. But the point is, they're an irrational story that drives irrational behaviour.
Well, you sort of talk about this in the book, don't you, around dog shit on the floor. Why would you wipe that up?
So if you come into a house and your dog's shit shat on the floor, you'll kind of clean it up, you'll put some bleach on, you'll get rid of it, okay? And if you ask why, you'll say, because the risk of infection, it's unhygienic, okay? But someone would have done exactly the same thing in the 19th century before we even knew that germs existed, okay? They might have said, you know, that feces is unholy, or it's, you know, whatever it might be. Someone who threw feces about would be condemned in the 19th century without anyone knowing the real reason why. The fact that your reasoning isn't good doesn't mean the story isn't good. Now, interestingly, you know, what about drugs that work and we don't know why? Right?
Which is actually quite common.
Which is incredibly good. Aspirin for, I think the ancient Egyptians used some sort of tree bark which contained aspirin. Okay. Mm. And it was only fairly recently they worked out why aspirin worked. An awful lot of drug discoveries. There's a really interesting company in Cambridge called Helex, which basically does science backwards. One of the co-founders was involved in the discovery of Viagra, which of course is a famous backwards discovery.
Yeah.
And their approach is, no, we won't define a disease and look for a way to cure it. We'll look for interesting compounds and see what they might cure. Now here, so one of the things I worry about is this urge to create a rational narrative around what you're doing and the need for people to justify every moment of their day to accountants and administrators, okay, totally destroys a kind of random happenstance discovery, which experience teaches us is probably the greater part of progress, all right? So in order to get funding for something, you've got to actually say, we've got this disease and we're trying to cure it. Okay, and we're looking at this particular role of the
T cells. You need a strong rationale.
A strong rationale. Now, if you look at actually how medical progress happens, there's a book called Against Method by Paul Feyerabend, which might be quite interesting to the nerdier listeners to your podcast on this. But he basically says that everything, that's all of them, isn't it? Okay. Right.
They're pretty nerdy, yeah.
But the point about this is that, you know, there was an earlier German pharmaceutical company which rejected Viagra precisely because it created an erection. Okay. Is it even clearly inappropriate to have people suffering from angina going around in a state of high tumescence? the British people noticed something weird. I've heard various stories about what they noticed, the people sitting in a weird way in the waiting room, or the fact that at the end of the trial, people wouldn't give their extra pills back. No, I'm not giving them back. Right. And they realised they'd actually discovered a cure for a different disease. Now, awful lot of stuff. I think an awful lot of research into weight gain probably needs to be done in the area of sleep, because I think that weight gain might be driven by actually poor quality sleep.
So, Rory, can I just ask, because we're talking about, in a way, embracing the messiness of the method.
The weirdest finding of mine was I lost weight during COVID when I was sitting for 8 hours a day, 20 feet from a fridge. And I thought, this is going to be a disaster for my weight. But actually, I had daylight because I could go for walks during the day because I wasn't in a bloody office.
Yeah.
So I actually got a bit more exercise. But more interestingly, I got an extra hour and a half of sleep a day. Okay, because I didn't have to get up and travel.
Yeah,
flexible working from a medical point of view is a potential breakthrough, by the way.
What was your question there, Tiago, though?
Oh, I was just going to say, how do you... No, I was just going to say, how do you... How do you sell that vision to a field, public health in this case? They don't like to take risks and embrace that messiness. How do you sell that?
And they need the narrative.
I think we're turning our back on about 70% of potential progress by trying to make it intentional. There's a quote from who was it? Harry Truman, who said, "Everything is possible. Anything is possible, just so long as you don't care who gets the credit." Okay. And I have a belief that anything is possible just so long as you don't have to justify in advance. Okay. And the extent to which we have, you know, hospitals are no longer run by doctors, they're run by administrators, university departments are run by administrators, not by academics, you know, advertising agencies are run by their finance department. And their need for intellectual neatness and sequence, and their failure to understand that most progress is kind of recursive or even backwards. Okay. Now, when I was a kid, I've got to be really careful about telling this because it'll get me cancelled. Back in the 1970s, in less politically correct time, there was a book, which I may or may not have owned, called The Irish Joke Book. It was called Book 3, Book 2 to Follow. Now, all cultures have these jokes. You know, it's Kerryman in Ireland. It was historically the Polish in whatever. And so you have these kind of jokes about the rural... They're basically anti-rural prejudice, actually, or anti-kind of recent immigrant prejudice, okay? Because you'd have recent immigrants who didn't really cotton on to, you know, things like that, you know, who didn't cotton on to the modus of, you know, a big city like New York or something like that. And they had a little joke which said that the Irish Nobel Prize for Medicine has been awarded to a man who's come up with a cure for which there is no known disease. And actually,
which
I've always thought that's Viagra, that's penicillin, right? Okay. That's also, I was talking to some people at a pharmaceutical company. They were working on a load of things which are immunosuppressants, and some of the compounds they tested basically had the opposite effect. And so they, of course, discarded them. And then they go, hold on a second. If we're trying to do immunotherapy for cancer, obviously, if you've got bloody, arthritis, that particular kind of arthritis, it's an immune disease where your immune system's attacking your body, basically, okay? Okay, and something that boosts your immune system is absolutely the last thing you need. But on the other hand, okay, if you've got a particular cancer, it might be a decisive cure, okay? So actually, doing it backwards, the Irish Nobel Prize for Medicine is actually a really good idea. Okay.
Yeah.
So I know this is the last public talk I'm ever going to give, but I will qualify this by saying this was the early 1970s, okay? And I was therefore below the age of responsibility. And I didn't even buy the book. Someone bought it for me as a present, okay? So, right, I think I've just provided the plausible deniability now.
Oh, God. Okay, that is a comment on society now that is the prerequisite to finish up with. I think this brings me to one of the points that... we're still on how did you get to where you are, by the way.
So if you notice, by the way, anecdotes are fine. Don't knock anecdotal information, because all new information emerges first in anecdotal form. It doesn't tell you what to do, but it tells you what to explore next, right? That's funny, this thing's happening. Let me take another look at it, okay? By the way, if you want the most interesting experiment, okay, on working from home and flexible working, on the day he discovered penicillin, Fleming was supposed to be working from home, but he was called in to an emergency at St Mary's Hospital, Paddington, and having travelled into the hospital, thought he might as well go and have a look at his petri dishes before he went back to East Anglia to his cottage. Okay. On the other hand, Isaac Newton effectively discovered gravity when he was actually during a pandemic, when he was forced to leave Cambridge and go and live somewhere in the deep countryside. So we have two conflicting stories there on the benefits of remote working. Okay.
But a lot on serendipity.
A hell of a lot on serendipity. And actually, I favour hybrid working, because the more different environments in which you work, the more likely you are to get inspiration. It's as simple as that. Okay.
So hybrid working right from the 1700s.
Yeah, absolutely. Onwards, really, yeah, absolutely right. 17th century hybrid working. Yeah, hybrid working. And
as endorsed by Isaac Newton.
But anecdotes, right? If you're doing reasoning backwards, anecdotes are useful, because... Now, I always say that in some ways, cops are more scientific than scientists are, because scientists have to do everything forwards, because we know this, what do we do next? I've reviewed the published literature, and I think we should now move to this next field, which is sequential and it's incremental, okay? Now, what cops have to do is what Conan Doyle or Sherlock Holmes called reasoning backwards, which is, we know there's a dead body on the floor, now we have to try and imagine and consider what prior conditions might have led to this happening. And if you look at detective work, I'm a serial killer and general sort of murder and true life crime fanatic. Okay?
I'm glad you...
I thought I was going to...
Okay, you've got to be careful there, Rory, because you said I'm a serial killer and child something... And the word fanatic saved you there, but that could have been...
No, I'm very keen on content around... My big Black Mirror episode, which I haven't written, is a world in which Netflix has to fund serial killers in order to have enough material to make documentaries in 2021.
Okay. Well, there's an idea. For them.
Yeah, we've got this guy Fred West, but he's running out of money and he needs a new van. But if you think backwards, it requires acts of the imagination, and it also requires beady-eyed observation of anomalies and outliers, not averages. Okay, it's different. Now, the story I always tell is that when they caught Levi Belfield, okay.
Who's that?
He was the guy who was responsible for the murder on Clapham Common. Wandsworth Common, was it? What's that common down there? But he was responsible for a string of murders, basically, including Emily de la Grange. He was responsible for... No, sorry, it was a chap called Napper who was responsible for the murder on the Common. Got that one wrong. He was responsible for Emily de la Grange and also for Millie Dowler. Okay, right.
Oh, right.
Okay. Now, the first bit of information they had, okay, was that someone basically wrote in, who was a former girlfriend of Belfield's, who said, Belfield was my boyfriend, and I once discovered one of my magazines, okay? And all the faces of the blonde women had been defaced or hacked about with a biro, right? Mm. Now, that's not admissible in a... Well, it's admissible in a court of law, I suppose, but it's not... No one's going to convict on that basis. It's not a criminal offence to deface a copy of Vogue. Well, it probably wasn't Vogue, I don't mention. The Belfield household was totally keen on the latest season of Balenciaga's latest catwalk show. I'm not sure the Belfield household went to... But it was some sort of women's magazine or
Bella magazine. Or whatever,
And it had been hacked about. Now... Again, no one, you can't convict on that basis, but it's significant and worthy of further investigation. With Peter Sutcliffe, there was a bit of information which was completely ignored, but it was simply the weird, the fact that he had a gap in his teeth, the fact that he was a lorry driver, the fact that his boots had a pattern of wear which you'd expect in a lorry driver, which they'd also found, And they ignored it. They ignored the, and also the fact that he reacted in a very weird way to the police investigation, which I haven't got time to explain. But everybody else, the cops who are doing door-to-door, basically had a bit of a joke they cracked to open up, because obviously you can't just knock at your door and say, we suspect you being the Yorkshire Ripper, right? Okay, so they had this brilliant little riff to the man and his wife, because the suspects were all male, obviously, which was, right, madam, now's your chance to get rid of your husband for good, which was a bit of a gag. Now, in 10% of cases, people became angry. In 90% of cases, people laughed. And when they went and interviewed Sutcliffe, there was just a deadpan response. There was no anger, there was no amusement. Nothing. And he just thought, it's a weird way to react. No one else has reacted like that. Now, that's irrelevant in a court of law, right? The fact they reacted in a funny way, okay, is not relevant, right? But it's still significant. And so this business of demanding p-values before you can investigate anything else and discarding anything else as anecdotal is completely wrong. If you look at great ad campaigns, this is why I'm talking about medicine coming from advertising, is that in advertising, the process basically happens backwards. You know, you stumble on a lucky break, you go, oh, that's kind of interesting. That thing you said there, which was actually a bit stupid, if we just tweak it, actually it could be quite useful.
It might work.
And sometimes, by the way, in advertising, you rewrite the question. If you come up with a great answer to a different question, you rewrite the brief. Okay, right?
Yeah. Well, that's quite... But this actually brings me to... I will get a question fully out, I think, in a minute. And it is... When you say, you know, you talk about in alchemy, childish questions, asking childish questions, and you've done it about, you know, standing on trains and things like that. But my so I'm going to combine a couple of questions. The one that I'm originally was...
Well, that childish question is, why do we hate standing
I won't
on
get
train?
A question.
Okay, sorry.
No, let me get this out right, because I want to point you in this direction, Rory, because I think it's really, it's bringing together a lot of what you're talking about anyway. And that is... that combinatorial thing and the whole systems thinking thing, right? There's in a world of resources where you can't, for example, throw... Because, I mean, the obvious answer is to whole systems obesity, for example, which is the world that I'm from.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay.
Is do all of those things, and you shouldn't expect, from like a marginal gains perspective, you shouldn't expect to be able to quantify the exact contribution of every one of the things that you're doing, but all of them have value, and it's the combinatorial effect that has that value.
And but in a world of resources, how do you choose which to... They always try and strip out things, to strip it back to the...
Yeah.
What you might call...
Well, because of cost, though.
The Occam's razor thing. But actually, it's the combination that probably works, to be honest.
So how do you justify the cost?
In me, the mental frame is, if I can't make a go of weight loss with these four factors all working in my favour, I'm never going to make it work. So I'm more determined to make it work. Okay? That's a sort of psychological thing. And I kind of derive a weird pervy pleasure from not eating. And that may be the semaglutide, which... The very interesting effect, by the way, is semaglutide. Have you seen this data from Goldman Sachs, where Walmart have... pharmacist data, and they also have shopping data because they operate their own pharmacies. Mm-hmm. And they notice a marked difference in shopping behaviour from people who've been prescribed Ozempic or the other American, whatever the other one's called.
Oh, well.
Okay. And it also seems, now this gets weirder still, it also seems to reduce propensity to other impulsive behaviours like gambling, which is really weird and unexpected, really? Right? That's the basic thesis, which is that it isn't just... Because so much of our mental apparatus is actually multi-purpose, okay? And that the urge to gamble and the urge to eat might be actually affected by part of the same brain. Maybe there's some sort of, you know, rush you get, which is diminished by this, okay? Whatever it may be. Okay? Because so much of the brain is effectively modular and multi-purpose. That actually, again, it's a cure for which there was no expected disease. You know, no one expected this bloody thing to affect gambling behaviour. But it may be decisive in that.
What's interesting about that is the people that have the best data on it are Walmart, not medical professionals or scientists, for example. That it comes from somewhere like consumerism.
Yes, I mean, the NHS potentially has an advantage there because it does have, in theory, okay, probably not in practice, the ability to do some really interesting kind of data connection here. But but you see, what I'm doing is I'm saying, look, I have this hunch that multiple things work combinatorially. And psychologically, it certainly makes sense that they do. We ought to at least investigate this before we're trying to actually prise apart the different components. We should be asking the question, well, maybe it's the combination of the components that's doing the work, not the individual additive function of the components, but their multiplicative value.
So I was speaking at a conference of sorts yesterday, like a lunch and learn thing, and they were talking about how they want to get Wegovy basically out on prescription. But I think
they got it in pill form now, haven't they, as well? I think if I'm right, the latest development.
I'm not sure, but they were more concerned because this woman was from the Caroline, her name was. She was from one of the integrated care systems. So she was working sort of in an integrated care system, I think in North or West Yorkshire. And they were saying the issue is the cost, justifying the cost and finding the cost. And this sort of is the crux of my question. When you have multiple options and the combinatorial effect of them would be effective, but you can't afford them all, how do you actually choose the ones that you prioritise in that environment? Because that is the situation.
Metformin isn't expensive, right? Metformin is dirt cheap, right? So that's, you know, it's a product of some plant or other. Okay, so you might as well bang that into the mix. Okay,
and right, okay.
Maybe what would happen if you commercialized it is I noticed a business on the tube yesterday which was renting garden offices. So the standard thing with a garden office is you pay like 25 grand and they build this thing. No, this one you pay £36 a month, or from £36 a month. That may be more of a shed. But okay.
Yeah.
But one of the things that commerce would do is they'd experiment, like a CPAP machine. Well, okay, there are a hell of a lot of people who can't afford 400 quid or whatever the things cost. Although Schumpeterian market size effects, they become a hell of a lot cheaper and smaller and better if the market were bigger and you didn't need a prescription.
I mean,
all credit to Rishi, right? His mum's a pharmacist. That business that pharmacies can now prescribe antibiotics is a great way to take pressure off the GP. Because if you think there's a 20% chance you might need antibiotics, okay, you're not going to go to the pharmacy because that'll just entail two trips, right? You know, it's like why now pharmacists are extremely well trained. I don't know if you have pharmacists among your listeners. Okay, it's a real skill, right? And they're treated as basically shopkeepers with a white coat, which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, it's true.
And you know, and so actually, once you know that pharmacies can prescribe antibiotics, you know, you might go to the pharmacist first. Saves a gratuitous trip to the GP. Mm. Okay, but secondly, the pharmacist can then play a really clever behavioural trick, which is, I'm going to give you a deferred prescription for antibiotics, post-dated, which is if this treatment doesn't go away in 3 days, you can come back in and redeem this and get some antibiotics. Yeah. Now, at that point, I'm basically happy, right?
Yeah.
And 90% of the time, the people won't come in because they'll save their 10 quid or whatever it is for a prescription. And because they start to get... Basically, the only time you want antibiotics when you've got a cold, even though antibiotics don't work for a cold, is when it's either getting worse or it's not getting better. The second you feel yourself getting a tiny bit better of your own you know, immune system kicks in, right? Yeah. The second you feel you've turned the corner, your urge for medication diminishes massively. Okay, so if you can just defer them enough so that they don't actually take the bloody pills right there and then, okay, then you've probably solved a hell of a lot of the problems of both over-medication and over-prescription of antibiotics and the problem of gratuitous visits to the GP.
For sure. I mean, they are actually, to be honest, pharmacists are part of the public health landscape as well. Yeah. They are sort of, you know,
massively,
they do offer weighing and measuring and prescriptions and then advice and even advice to people as well, that are sort of part of that consultative effect that you get from you know, seeing a GP, for example.
And undoubtedly, if you feel the pharmacist isn't allowed to prescribe antibiotics, first of all, it diminishes the pharmacist. Okay. Mm,
true.
But secondly, it also means, well, why go? It means, you know, why go to the monkey when I can talk to the organ grinder problem?
Yeah, yeah.
And there must be other things. Like, I mean, when I had kids, The main reason you go to the GP isn't for treatment, it's for reassurance, right? Okay. Now, this is, okay, a mischievous and totally unethical experiment, but you could have a video of health service where you employed actors who looked like doctors and they wore white coats on Zoom. And yeah, if you rang up and said, I feel ill, they go, yeah, there's a lot of it about. And as soon as you hear there's a lot of it about, 90% of your fear goes, right? Now, the worst thing you can say to somebody is, I've never seen anything like this ever before in my life. Right, okay. Reassurance is sometimes just telling people, you know that business where you get a power cut, and the first thing you do when you have a power cut is you go out in the street and you go, oh, thank fuck for that. Everybody else's life is
around. Everyone.
Well,
yeah.
It's everybody's problem. Yeah. It's not my problem. Okay.
Yeah, yeah,
so I can just sit back, light a candle, and, you know, whatever you do when you know, in the dark. Okay.
Yeah.
And whereas if yours is the only house that's out, you're really, really worried. So a huge amount of this stuff is reassurance. Now, if you have kids, it's multiplied by 10 because it's got the whole, I'd never forgive myself if this were meningitis and I didn't bother. So you take your child to the bloody doctor when they fart, basically. Yeah. Okay. Now, allowing the pharmacist to perform certain tests, okay, that provide reassurance, okay, would be a really, really valuable, you know, because this is that whole question. You got to my point about why do people really do things? Okay, and the logical explanation is we go to the doctor to get better because we want treatment and pills. Well, the psychological reason, particularly if you're a parent, is 90% it's blame avoidance or regret avoidance. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'd never forgive myself if. Okay. That's why it's
also
up.
Understanding the real reasons, and this is some of the things that you talk about in the book, really. And the example I think you use
the real reason.
Like the plane, for example, the plane delay. If you want to summarise that in like a minute, because I think that's interesting. It's the lack of control.
Yes, yeah. But. So understanding the psychological. Now, this has a really important bearing on waiting lists, by the way.
Yeah.
Now, I can't take the credit for this, but I hang out quite a lot. Two people you ought to interview for your podcast. One of them's Michael Sagner, who's the head of the European Centre for Preventive Medicine. Very, very interesting doctor. And another one is Professor Rob Horn, who's like the professor of placebos at University College London, although they don't call it that, okay? And there are two people I talked to, and I said, well, what's the problem with a waiting list? There must be things for which there are waiting lists, okay, where the waiting is desirable. For example, an awful lot of orthopaedic stuff, the pain goes away of its own accord. Actually, treating people or operating too early on back pain is almost certainly a fatal mistake. Now, I've been a copywriter for 30 years, right? And Rob said, well, you could change the whole perception of a waiting list by making it preparation for your operation, not, okay, waiting. Okay?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there are some things. Nightclubs actually have manufacture queues because it makes the nightclub look really desirable. So it's not a necessary rule that all queues are bad things. You know, it can well, you know, this surgeon's absolutely brilliant, but you'll have to wait 3 months for him. I'll go, yeah, absolutely fine. If you've done 15,000 and the other guy's only done 3, yep, that's what I'll do. Okay. Sure. And then you reframe the timers, but in order to get the most value out of this, you need to prepare for the operation by losing weight, by doing some exercises, by improving your sleep quality, whatever it may be. Okay, get ready for the operation. And if the NHS did something like, we'll send you one of those Roly tube things for your back. Okay, right? Mm-hmm. And that came through the post, the NHS. Because you're not expecting the NHS to send you anything that you haven't begged for, you'd be going, this is brilliant. Yeah. Okay, this is what happened at St. Thomas's Hospital. I went in for a detached retina and they said, oh, well, we'll refer you to the sleep clinic. Oh, that's brilliant. You're actually doing something.
Is that how you got your CPAP?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Oh, right. It was St. Thomas's referred me to East Grinstead, I think. I think I've got that right.
Right.
That's how it should be working. And as soon as the NHS looks a bit proactive, we tend to go, God, that's brilliant. Because our expectations aren't of the highest. And the NHS is basically a brilliant service with a terrible user interface. Okay? That's basically the way to describe most of healthcare. It's actually a really, really good service. I've got a friend who's like the head of Ogilvy's head of UX, and he's American. Okay? And I said, what's your experience of the NHS? And he's a UX expert. He said, I think the actual service is utterly brilliant. You know, I'm American. I think the service is fantastic. But the interface is terrible, right?
Yeah.
And if you sent someone, you know, exercises to do and a course of action to do while they were waiting for their operation, you'd both improve the efficacy of the operation, but you'd reframe the wait as a benefit, not as a bug. Okay, it's a feature, not a bug. I'll give you a lovely idea, a medicinal example of reframing. Okay, when they first developed the thing that became Night Nurse, it was intended to be an all-day flu remedy, but it had the problem that it sent everybody to sleep. So you couldn't drive or operate heavy machinery. And the marketing guy said, hold on a second, before you abandon this product, okay, if you position it as a nighttime flu remedy and call it Night Nurse, okay, the fact that it sends you to sleep isn't a bug, it's a feature.
It's an add-on,
It's an also had a great song with it as well.
Oh, yeah,
it had a great reggae song with it. I remember it now. It's great. Tiago, do you want to see it? I always catch Tiago singing when he's not, when he doesn't think we're recording.
He doesn't think we're recording. He'll start.
Sing it, Tiago. Tiago's from Portugal, so he won't actually know it, probably.
Bit of fado. We'll have a bit of fado later.
I'm more familiar with that.
Fabulous.
One of the questions I had for you, Rory, was actually around... It was actually from another guest we had on the show, who I met through Nudgedog, actually, in 2020.
Brilliant.
Adam Ferrier from Thinkabell, you know, in Australia.
Aussie, fantastic Brilliant guy.
Absolutely great guest, yeah. He's really, really funny, really good. Actually, the Aussies do humour in their marketing really I have to say that.
Go to Australia for intellectual stimulation, because I've got a friend who's also an Australian economist called Nick Gruen. And what I realise is it's like Australian fauna, right? It's evolved in isolation. So Australian intellectual life is more interesting than kind of Anglo-American intellectual life, precisely because they're a long way from everybody else. So they can't... You don't get kangaroos in Europe. You know what I mean? You need that kind of slight isolation. Probably true of New Zealand as well. Yeah.
Well, what I loved about... I mean, his book was called... oh, God, I should know what that is. But it's something like Stop Asking the Customer or something like that. And you talk about it as well a lot. And
people don't know we're a post-rationalizing species, not a rational.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And in our field, we're trying to pre-rationalize that post-rationalization, which is what you talk about there.
Yeah, exactly.
So, in a world that needs that, how do you stop asking the customer?
Yeah.
How do you stop?
You've got to understand that their explanation for things is a best guess designed to make them look sensible. Okay.
Yeah.
And so things which are silly. Okay, tend to get downweighted. Okay, and so it's what I always talk about. You know, why did you buy a swimming pool? Okay, now the ostensible reason is to swim in. Okay, but Nassim Taleb and I had this conversation, which is the real reason you buy a swimming pool is one, for a form of hospitality. You can host pool parties, and secondly, because you can walk around your garden in the summer wearing a bathing costume without feeling like a dickhead.
Being judged.
being judged. Yeah. Okay?
That's a very good point. Yeah.
You know, and so you know the actual benefits from things may not be what is envisaged, and this is what you might call the Viagra effect. Okay, it's actually it's the discounted side effect, as in the German pharmaceutical company, which may be more important than the intended effect. Because, of course, in the real world, there's no such thing as a side effect. They're just effects, right?
True, yeah, true. Absolutely.
You know,
true.
Okay, they're just effects.
I thought you were going to say take some Viagra, then walk around in the garden for a minute.
That would be inadvisable.
I thought you were sticking to the pool thing.
No. I moved away from the pool thing. No, you're right.
We've moved on from that one, so this is a question that we had from sort of right at the beginning, really, is like, This notion of childish questions, asking childish questions, not asking the customer and having to sort of do the post-rationalisation thing for people who need it, right? And then being Rory Sutherland, for example, because Tiago and I were talking about this before you came on. So you're a bit quirky now, and well, you said you were then. How can you be weird, quirky, however you want to describe
indirect
it.
Marketing.
Ask childish questions and not put people off.
Indirect marketing, I've seen enough examples where the decisive factor is something that no one would mention in market research, that no economist would deem to be an important factor of consideration. And since most decisions are taken using either A market, it's what I call the broken binoculars. There's A market research, which doesn't cover the waterfront and in fact buries many important things, because people are trying to look intelligent in front of a bunch of strangers. Then you have economic theory, which is based on a load of assumptions about human motivation, which are kind of pretty whack, okay? And then you have what you observe with the eye of a kind of comedian. I think one of the greatest creative boons to the Brits and to the world was Python-esque humour. You know, the Ministry of Silly Walks, the kind of revelling in absurdity, okay? I think it's one of the most important facets. And interestingly, John Cleese has written a book I thoroughly recommend on this topic, which is called Creativity, a Shortened Friendly Guide, which is a really short book, and it's a wonderful book to read, along with a book called Obvious Adams by Robert Updegraff, which was written in 1916, that looks like a completely hokey American business book, but when you finally finished it, it's brilliant. It was one of David Ogilvy's favourite books, funnily enough.
On what creativity. Was that called?
Obvious Adams.
Okay.
And Robert Updegraff, it's still in print, you know, 107 years later.
Wow, okay.
And it looks like a hokey bit of American folksy wisdom, and actually when you finally finished it, it only takes you about half an hour to read, you go, actually, this book's sort of changed my life. But the Python-esque humour thing is you notice something and go, actually, it's not impossible. So here's an example of something which is almost impossible to instigate, because rationally, looking at rational measures like speed and capacity, it doesn't make sense, okay? Mm-hmm. But which I think is brilliant. Have you ever travelled from Heathrow Terminal 5?
Yeah.
The BA Terminal. Next time you go, if you're parking, even if you're not parking, even if you've arrived by tube, okay, go, if you've got enough time on arrival or before departure, go down to the Heathrow pod parking and take the Heathrow pod to the business pod parking car park. And it's a little autonomous electric vehicle that scuttles along at about 30 miles an hour, and you basically get in, you say where you want to go, and it goes, you want to go to pod parking B, and the door opens and you get in, and it just goes wee, and you sit there, okay, right? And it goes up on a bit of an elevated gantry. It's very cheap to build the track because it doesn't require rails. Now, I said, the point is, you can never get funding to build that bloody pod parking thing anywhere else, because it's less capacity than a bus, okay? It's slower than a tube train, okay? All those tedious rational measures which we're supposed to care about when we travel. But the simple fact is, one, there's privacy because you're on your own, okay?
Mm-hmm. True.
Okay, that's the first thing, okay? Secondly, you don't have to wait. You don't have the anxiety and the uncertainty of waiting for a shuttle bus, not knowing when it's going to come.
Yeah.
Okay? And I mentioned that fact with airports, that the major fear of delays in air travel, okay, is the uncertainty of the delay, not the duration. If it says flight BA264 delayed 2 hours, you go, oh, bit of a bummer, I'll go to the lounge, or I'll go to the bar, I'll get on with a bit of work. Never mind, I'll make a few phone calls, explain it, I'm going to be late, that's all fine. If it just says BA264 delayed, you're in a total funk, you've got to spend every 3 minutes, you've got to look at the board again,
you're going around looking
for people asking for information. You're meant.
Yeah.
So it's not the quantity of time that matters, it's the quality of the time spent waiting. And that's my argument with NHS waiting lists. Don't obsess exclusively on the quantity. Obviously, I'm not talking about oncology here. I'm not talking about life-threatening conditions, right?
Mm-hmm,
but 80% of the waiting lists in the NHS, which they're trying to reduce, are not for those time-sensitive things. I mean, you know, I had a detached retina. They saw me in a day, okay, because it's a time-sensitive thing, right? Generally, the things people are waiting for are not super time-sensitive. If they are, that should be fixed. Don't get me wrong. But we shouldn't measure waiting time regardless of the medical condition. Because you could actually reframe and indeed repurpose that waiting time to be useful. And a second thing, by the way, and I'm going to ask this question because there must be people more expert than me, don't give me one appointment for our operation, give me three. And say, we'll try and get you in for the earliest date, but if not, it'll be one of the two later ones. Now, that gives you a degree of flexibility. If you have an emergency, for example, you can bump me. Without creating the total panic that I've moved to the back of the queue. This is a psychological factor, by the way, that if you have waiting and you see the triage nurse and they get you to wait in a different area, you feel much happier than if you're sent back to the original waiting room.
Progress,
because you feel you're making progress. So psychologically, and I think logistically, I can easily go to my employer and go to my PA in my case and say, don't book anything in on these 3 days because I may need it for an operation. It's a day case, okay? Just block these 3 dates out. Okay, I won't go on holiday. I won't take any immovable meetings because I need to keep them clear from operation. It doesn't have to be just one, right? Could be three. And then they can ring me up and say, I'm afraid we'll have to... Okay, well, nobody's having these conversations.
No, but are you having these conversations with anyone in health at any point? Yeah. Or
I've tried to.
Why are you thinking about these if you're not actually involved in them? I mean, seemingly because you've got...
Because behavioural economics is fractal and it's replicable. This isn't about universal laws. It's about pattern recognition.
Yes.
And things that work for a small thing. That's why I make no apology for working in advertising, any more than Darwin should have apologised for looking at the beaks of finches, right? On its own.
Which
maybe,
he didn't know would work out, by the way.
He didn't know it would work out, did he, at the time, right?
Yeah.
And so, sorry about that, just having a bit of chowder.
No worries.
Very healthy. And soup, by the way, is part of the... I said this to Nestle once. Have you actually thought that the solution...
Rory, have you got ADHD? Just out of interest.
Probably. My daughter has a bit,
Because I do, and I... but the way you ADHD, go about it...
ADHD is a superpower. It shouldn't be medicalised. It's a fucking superpower.
There's upsides and downsides for sure, but the sort of ping ponging is brilliant to watch, and also it reminds me of me, but on speed actually.
You wouldn't want to see me on speed, I'm sure. I've never tried it.
Ironically, speed actually helps with ADHD. I never took the medication. I got it.
I was going to say, you advocating for it?
It was speed. Yeah, it was speed, and it was called lisdexamfetamine. And it's because it's attaching to the dopamine system rather than it's speeding up your ability to connect with the dopamine system.
But to get back to the Heathrow pod thing, just I do generally
yes, yeah,
return.
Do that. Yeah.
Basically, people love it, right? I've got a colleague who was in his 60s. He used to turn up in his Jag to go on a business meeting. I said, "I'm terribly sorry, the pod parking's free, but we've upgraded you at no extra cost to the short stay parking." And he was supposed to react with, "Oh, that's fantastic. Thank you for your generosity." And he went, "Mama, but I wanted to ride on the pod."
Okay. It's the experience side of things.
People absolutely love it. And you can prove that because the price of the pod parking is not that unadjacent to the price of the short stay parking. Whereas the long stay parking, where you have a bus shuttle every 10 minutes, that's like half the price. So people really like the pod. Now, that's the relevant factor here. It's not speed. Those are all proxy measures. The only measure that matters is the emotional measure.
Yeah. Do people He's thinking about the experiential goods.
Of course.
Yeah. See experiential now, goods, not just the goods.
How do you bring that, though, coming back to my point, how do you bring that into a room of risk-averse people? I'm not saying that it's the people, it's the industry that is risk-averse. Quite naturally, we're risk-averse. There's not a lot of money in that area. Like, it's all right having these conversations with, you know, the likes of Unilever and
go and interview a guy called Gerd Gigerenzer, who's the author of a book called Risk Savvy, and he's done a lot of work in medicine, which shows that medical decision-making is often defensive decision-making.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, I think it is.
It's optimization. Sorry, it's blame avoidance masquerading as optimization. Basically,
well, I think the industry sort of is sort of I know what you mean. You're sort of having to back up your decisions with an email trail and whatever else. And I think the thing that I think most when I've read your book numerous times,
and fear of ridicule, by the way, is both rational and very, for sure, very strong. And if you want to know that, you've got the perfect medical case study, which is Semmelweis.
Well, with the hand washing thing.
The hand washing, yeah. He died in the lunatic asylum, basically being, I think we might have been beaten to death by the guards, but he died in a lunatic asylum because he was basically right. I mean, that is the most terrifying story in many senses.
For those who don't know that story. It's one of the saddest stories.
Okay, well, you better do it because my ADHD will suddenly get me talking about dinosaurs.
I'm with you. I'm the same. Normally, Tiago's keeping me on track.
You better keep this on track. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I'll try my best.
But so it comes back down to the same thing in that when you're trying to make those decisions in environments where money's tight, you know, like, yeah, you've got big corporations that are willing to spend money on weird stuff. And even then you said, you know, being you and being in a position of with high social capital, saying weird stuff still sometimes for you is quite embarrassing in that room when they're expecting one set of solutions and you're going off on a different tangent, for example.
I think you can create a space with permission. I think you can create almost a meeting with no agenda, okay? Every now and then, groups that meet should have a meeting with no agenda where you're free to actually riff and where you create the conditions where such suggestions are acceptable and not socially embarrassing, because people have a lot of reputational, you know, skin in the game. And, you know, one of the most depressing things, by the way, also talk to marketing people, because every single behavioural change thing or every single medical intervention is actually a door with two locks, in a sense. There's the medical pharmacological lock and there's the behavioural lock. And if you don't unlock both of those, the door doesn't open. We tend to think of them as sequential doors. Well, we'll sort out the medicine first and then we'll worry about the marketing later. I was probably one of the reasons I got involved with a lot of medical people. And by the way, I'm from a medical family. bizarrely. Okay, so that's another reason I get involved. So I'm this ad guy, but my grandfather was the doctor at the Treger Working Men's Medical Cooperative Society, which is basically where Nye Bevan got the idea from for the NHS. So he was employed by that extraordinary organisation, which was, in a sense, the kind of forerunner of the NHS in microcosm. Mm-hmm. So I come from a medical family, and I like combining the two because I've got friends who are medical, who were medical students, who are now doctors and so on. A very close friend who's a Canadian nephrologist. Mm-hmm. We had a very interesting conversation about, you know, doctors getting paid more for in-person appointments than remote appointments. I can see that telemedicine and indeed remote hospital wards, where people are monitored at home but remotely, are a huge, huge opportunity for the NHS. And my terror is they get positioned as the poor man's version of the physical thing.
Yeah.
I'm terrified that because it's cheaper, video conferencing, should have been sold as the rich man's phone call, but it was sold as the poor man's British Airways. And in the same way, I'm terrified that telemedicine... Now, fortunately with the NHS, when the NHS gives me whizzy electronic gadgets, I'm so surprised by the fact that the NHS is actually giving me something, I'm automatically impressed. I think there are ways in which we can do this. My CPAP machine, by the way, reports back to East Grinstead on how frequently I'm using it and what the quality of my sleep is. And I've suddenly realised why it hasn't reported today. It's because I unplugged it because I'm going down to Deal this evening. So that's why I got 95% on Wednesday night. I don't know Thursday night sleep quality yet, but I'll know when I plug it back in because it's connected to the mobile phone network. Okay.
Do you know there's probably a massive placebo effect in that as well, or
gamification. Gamification of the sleep quality thing is a thing, definitely. Absolutely right.
But and also the confidence you have in going to bed. So this is a weird thing about me, right? Is I didn't think it was weird.
Just the one, yes, Stu.
Yeah, well, no. I was speaking to my mate the other day, and I was saying, you know, like when you go to bed, and I go to bed quite early because I get up early. So I said, you know, when you go to bed and you've got a problem, and then you just wake up and the solution's there, and you can get up and write about it. And I get up at 4 and I just crack on with the solution or whatever. And he went, no, not at all. That's not normal, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what do you do? He said, if I've got a problem and I go to bed, I'm worried about it all night. And I don't sleep well. And then I wake up with a terrible, you know, and then I'm worse off. And I'm like, oh, no, I have the opposite to that. And I sort of think there's this, like, I didn't know it's not exclusive to me, obviously, but it's something that I have complete confidence in. And that confidence gives me even more confidence, if you like. It's sort of self-replicating because I'll just go to sleep and then I'll wake up with it.
There's an even weirder explanation, of course, which is that snoring, why did it not evolve out? Because you'd think advertising your presence to a predator when you're asleep.
Yeah.
It turns out that the animals that snore are either apex predators like lions or tigers that don't have to give a shit about it, right? Because nothing's going to bother them. Or they're herd species or pack species because it's to your advantage to wake up your sleeping companions while remaining asleep yourself.
Yeah, true.
So snoring is actually basically it's evolutionarily adaptive because you outsource alertness to the people you're sleeping with so you can have a better sleep yourself.
Yeah. That is annoying. I was with a snorer on a trip recently, and I was furious. I was absolutely furious.
No, absolutely livid.
He was fine. He woke up, lovely night's sleep. But I was absolutely furious.
Apex predator, that is.
But I mean, the extraordinary CPAP machine. I would consumerize it because then it'll get cheaper, and it's going to be a bit unfair. Now this is an important point, because rich people are going to buy them, and poor people can't afford them. But that's how things become affordable. Dishwashers, my grandparents were the fourth family in Wales to own a dishwasher, which is, there's posh for you, right? They went into Cardiff and there was a New Zealand made thing called Dishmaster. It still works, even though they bought it in the 1950s, by the way. It still works because that's how well built it was. They have needed to replace the impeller a few times, but that's all. They said, have you sold many of these? And they said, yeah, we sold three in Cardiff and one in Wrexham, two in Cardiff and one in Wrexham or something. One in Newport. I can't remember what it was. And literally, it's the fourth dishwasher in Wales. Now, it cost the price of a small car. But the point is that rich people actually fund the early stage development of technologies like flat screen TVs, so they become affordable to more and more people. So there probably is an advantage to consumerising the CPAP machine. Rich people have probably, you know, effectively funded the early stage development of Ozempic as well, to an extent, you know.
And
prescribed it. Rich countries certainly have.
And electric cars and all sorts of other things. Yeah. You know,
that's kind of how it works, and that's actually
it is how it works.
You know, that's.
But
you know,
I think see having that conversation and knowing that is important, because we are quite rightly hyper obsessed with leveling up and making sure we reduce inequalities, but knowing how real market forces work.
Sometimes they work that way. Sometimes that does not work. Okay, just to be clear.
No.
But I always think, you know, there are democratizing forces. I always think one of the greatest things to happen to Britain was TK Maxx, because once TK Maxx came on, you could no longer tell how rich someone was by their clothes. I thought it was a decisive social moment in the evolution of the UK. I don't know if you're a TK Maxx fan. I used to be
when I would spend time going through the racks and stuff because I was from a working class background, so yeah, that I'm with you. As soon as TK Maxx became a thing, I was straight down there, because I used to buy, and this is, I shouldn't admit this, but I used to buy fake stuff from people in markets and whatever else. So TK Maxx it was a massive upgrade to me. So
lovely story from Thailand, which is Ogilvy in Thailand used to produce T-shirts branded Ogilvy for the company, for things like, you know, softball evenings, or, you know, if they had a sporting event or they had a company conference, they'd produce these Ogilvy branded T-shirts they gave people to wear. And they became so common that somebody in Thailand assumed this was a luxury fashion brand, and someone discovered fake Ogilvy T-shirts on sale in the market.
That is great.
So we'd accidentally become a fashion brand. I totally agree about that. I would argue that the NHS probably needs an equivalent of premium economy. That's my father's complaint. My father's quite stingy and he's 93. But he just goes, you know, if it's phlebotomy I need, you know, why can't I just pay to have someone come to my house? You know, he's 90, he's 94 now, is he? 93. Okay, well, you know, okay, I get it. I can go to the surgery, but I'm 93. It's quite difficult. I don't mind paying. You know, he said, I pay 20 quid for things all the time. I don't mind paying 20 quid for someone to come round or whatever, you know.
So I think... In thinking about what this is going to be like to cut this podcast together, I was just thinking, so bear in mind that a lot of our listeners are from academics. They might be senior academics.
I like it
for that reason. I think it's sort of, you know, it's deliberately supposed to be about bringing people from completely different backgrounds and saying, what do you think about these things?
My suggestion that's never been adopted is, if you want people to finish their course of antibiotics, don't give them 32 white pills, okay? Give them 26 white pills and 6 blue ones, and tell them to take the white ones first and then take the blue ones. And then people go, oh, I better do that then, right?
Yeah, the blue ones.
If it's white pills, they'll just go, oh, I feel a bit better now, same. I won't bother. Same.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so with them, I'm just thinking about listeners here, and with them in mind, normally we ask a question of, like, what if you were if you were either in a job, or if you were just coming out of uni or whatever, and you were thinking about getting into behavioural science in some way, because we don't have a lot of, there are behavioural science teams popping up all over the place, by the way.
Well, which is great, because people who did a psychology degree suddenly realise they can actually get a job, which is fantastic.
Which is good.
Because they're great people, right? They're fantastically interesting people. And, you know, previously, they just go into something at random. Now, the fact that you can parlay your psychology degree into something, you know, really useful. And the point I make is, don't feel any apology for working on commercial projects, because I said this is pattern recognition. You can learn something about how you sell chocolate bars, okay? Mm. And that can be applied to how you get people to adhere to a medical procedure. And similarly, you can learn, as Darwin did, you can look at the trivial and then generalise up.
But I think the thing for me is there's probably a financial reason this won't happen, but people having spent time at Ogilvy or you know, agencies and places like that, particularly in marketing, because I think marketing's got so much to offer in normal language that we can then think about, you know, behavioural science.
Yeah, nobody talks to, I mean, it's silly, because marketing's become stereotyped as kind of marcoms, and it's considered the icing on the cake. And sometimes it is the icing on the cake, but sometimes it needs to be the cake. So if you look at all inventions, well, I mean, I'll stick to medical things for now, Okay, I could also talk about James Watt, who invented the horsepower as a metric for selling steam engines. Okay, which is that mine owners, who are the people who bought steam engines, didn't want to know about piston stroke length and, you know, boiler capacity. They want to know, how many horses can I get rid of if I buy a steam engine? So James Watt said, if you buy 25 horsepower,
that's a good point. Right? Yeah.
Now, most inventors, Edison, Steve Jobs, most inventors are really marketers because they've unlocked both doors. They've made the thing physically available, but they've also made it mentally available and attractive. Yeah. Okay, they've unlocked both the doors. And in the case of medicine, one of the most extraordinary things is that you always imagine that Jenner basically came up with, you know, cowpox vaccination. By the way, why do they never try inoculation for COVID? Sorry, not variolation for COVID. Okay, in other words, infecting people with a small amount of the actual virus in the skin, not in the lungs, and seeing whether you could foster immunity that way. Don't know, but I mean, nobody tried it, which is a bit weird, isn't it? Right? Because variolation. Oh, okay. But when Jenner came up with vaccination, okay, as opposed to variolation, which I think was the technique that preceded it, okay, for smallpox, you'd assume that basically he was just awarded loads and loads of honours and just retired on the proceeds or became massively famous. He spent most of his life as a marketer, basically overcoming resistance to people who had a vested interest in the prior method of treatment. It was exactly the same in medicine with keyhole surgery, because you had a whole load of people who had, you know, in the United States, kind of had yachts and second homes on the back of doing some particular operation, and suddenly you could do it with a little wiggly thing without actually, you know, cutting people open. And so you get this, you know. And the resistance always sounds sincere at first, because no one says, I'm going to lose my livelihood if this takes off. In fact, they don't even think that. They're just opposed to it because it threatens their livelihood and their status. So they will then post-rationalise reasons why it's not a good idea. That's fundamentally how it works.
But
read the book on status, by the way. Status Games, by a very good British-American journalist. I think it's called The Status Game. If you read that, you realise it's like gravity in human affairs. Status is just this force that acts on us all the time, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so this sort of does link still to what I'm asking you, which is how, if we believe, and you've talked about this before in books and talks about the importance of diversity. The problem I think we're getting is that we are still, even in public health, for example, where we are getting behavioural science teams pop up, they are usually health psychology graduates that are going into those roles. I think there's a huge role for applied sociologists in those areas, because I've always loved Pierre Bourdieu, so I was glad to see him get mentioned in your book, actually.
You're right. The idea of that, is it the habitus and the...
The habitus is absolutely wonderful. I love that, and I've always loved it. It's always been part of how I design business.
Gillian Tett, by the way, read her book on the silo effect. Because I imagine she mostly starts talking about investment banking because she's an FT journalist, but she trained as an anthropologist. Yeah. That must apply in medicine to an extraordinary degree, which is that your status, if you're an up-and-coming nephrologist, you're much better off grovelling to really senior nephrologists than you are hanging out with people who talk about, for example, remote monitoring tech. And you certainly don't want to hang out with the people from dermatology, okay? Right? You have these weird status things, don't you, in medicine, which are unbelievably kind of acute. And real progress is happening at the intersection of the disciplines, not within them, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of the point, really, is you've got applied sociologists have got way less options, by the way, than any other profession that I can see, because there's no obvious routes through for them into those. But they're so important in terms of really understanding, again, from an ethnographic standpoint or whatever it is, how to bring interesting things together. And I think marketing does that. I think people like Steve Jobs did that, for example, et cetera.
Absolutely.
How do you breed diversity into that? How do you bring sociologists, people from UX and from tech and from marketing and all that into an industry when that industry is probably paying less?
Worst thing that could happen in the silo effect is that the people who discover a rheumatoid arthritis treatment which has the opposite of the intended effect then throw it away without talking to the oncologists, okay? And that is literally possible within narrow silos. If you get people over-invested in, you know, to a man with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so creating that kind of conversation. And I'm very optimistic about video conferencing and webinars as a kind of opportunity to do this, because I occasionally pitch together, up. So I went to a conference at Nesta yesterday, which is all about effectively reinventing popular democracy through citizens' assemblies or citizens' juries, where you select people at random, but you give them 3 or 4 days to discuss a problem or issue and see what a representative group of people come up with. Now, I think that's hugely important for psychological reasons, because I think one of the reasons we have a problem with politics is people have noticed that the political class are completely unrepresentative of normal people, but also are actually become abnormal as a byproduct of going into politics. So one of the phenomena I noticed is that when Ed Balls was a Labour politician, he drove me practically insane, as Michael Portillo drove a load of people insane when he was actually a Conservative politician, okay? And drove me fairly insane at times, okay? But once those people actually get out of politics, they seem actually incredibly sane and intelligent people. So I have wondered if there's a way of using retirement, or where either people who've reached a level of eminence where they're unassailable, or else retirement, to allow people to become polymaths again. I'm not retiring because I want to stop work, okay? I'm not retiring because I want to stop work. I'm retiring because I want to stop commuting. Okay, that's why I'll retire, right? And there are loads of things you could do with the NHS, by the way, to get people back in part-time, okay? You know, there are a load of retired GPs who, if you gave them the right working conditions, could come back to work, okay? Mm-hmm. Right? There are loads of, or they could be telemedicine people. They don't want to stop doing medicine. They just don't want to turn up at a bloody surgery every five days a week and then tell people to ring back at 8 o'clock the following morning.
How can we create... Oh, it does annoy me. How can we create...
That's driven by a metric, by the way. It's nothing to do with customer interest. Yeah. It's a metric that if you make everybody ring back the following morning, your metric for number of patients who get an appointment on the day of requesting one hits 100%, so you can check a box.
Yeah.
Now, there are a load of people in jobs, not my job, okay, but there are a load of people like postmen who can't just take a day off at short notice. They need to, you know, they need to book a GP's appointment for next Tuesday, right? Yeah, and those people can't do it. That's where metrics, the need to compare and quantify, makes us stupid, you know.
Yeah, it's a great point. Mm-hmm. And my challenge really is how do you get so I love the Nudge Doc, you know, like I went to it years ago, loved it. Couldn't afford to go to the one in person. I was in behavioural science, but not as much at that point. And we've always been quite sort of, you know, we're part of a bigger American.
If you're in weight loss, you're in behavioural science. Trust me, as a fat guy, take it from me. Okay,
for sure. I am with you. We've been on that journey for a long time, and I'm we're now part of a bigger organisation, a bigger American firm. So we could afford to do stuff like that now, but. My point is, like, all of the good stuff to me, I had to go and find in my own time, in my own space. I had to pay for myself, etc. Yeah. Because in our field, there isn't the money available to go to Nudge Doc, for example.
And it's not the norm.
It's now online. Pardon?
And it's not the norm.
It's not the norm.
And it's not the norm, yeah. And when I came back, so I'm on the board for the... So we record this Real World Behavioural Science podcast on behalf of the Behavioural Science and Public Health Network, right? Mm. And one of the people who's been on the show, she was a founding member, Angel Chater. She's great.
I
talked about coming back from Nudge Doc and full of ideas and all this other stuff, you know. And I've been talking about behavioural economics as well as behavioural science generally and sociology for a while. And there was a lot of scepticism. Like Angel was sceptical. A few other people were sceptical about, you know, should we be including ideas from places like Ogilvy and people like, you know, Dan Ariely at the time, which actually did turn out to have some problems. Yes. But, you know, that it was interesting. They were sort of quite dismissive about some of those people. And I think that if we could get people like you and Ogilvy and places like that involved and interested enough...
Yeah.
If there was enough money in it to draw you in conversations.
My job here is not, you know, is as much impresario as it is practitioner, okay, which is raising the level to which this thing gets talked about. Now, I know there's a kind of academic purity about that, which is that if you get involved in anything commercial, you've somehow sullied yourself.
And it's
a huge problem, because if you want to solve if you want to solve this problem of healthier eating, actually, you're going to have to talk to McDonald's, okay? You're going to have to talk to Nestle. You're going to have to talk to these organisations, because they have a power of distribution and, an efficacy, okay? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, all the academic papers in the world aren't going to match. I mean, I have no, you know, I make no apology for that. By the way, you know, these, you know, the you know, an awful lot of this stuff, by the way, okay, I mean, the focus, the malign focus on fat rather than sugar in the diet came from bad academia. Let's be honest about that, okay? Right? Well, I mean, the extent to which sugar... No. There was a guy called Yudkin, and I know this because I went to Christ College, Cambridge, and he was the head... He was the chief medic at Christ College, Cambridge, back in the 30s or 40s or something. And he wrote a book called Pure, White and Deadly, Attacking Refined Sugar. And the American health establishment... You're going up with the car, are you? Yeah. The American health establishment, probably in league with or funded by the sugar lobby, basically got him portrayed as a lunatic. I mean, he was like 0.1 of a Semmelweis, you know. I don't think he ended up in a lunatic asylum getting beaten to death by the guards. But that was that's the kind of thing which happens in academia. Don't think that academia is like this really fucking lovely world where everybody's just out. I mean, it's much more political than business, okay? Secondly, okay, right? Business is much more collaborative because you'll work with anybody if you can see a way of making a bit of money out of it, even people you don't like very much, okay? Whereas the unbelievable fissiparous nature of academia are the rivalries and the status sensitivity and the... You know, the extraordinarily weird sort of status culture that emerges there isn't actually very conducive to all kinds of cooperation. It's...
Well, Tiago's and it's
There was a guy who left J. Walter Thompson, the ad agency, and became an academic, and he said that the politics were so much worse in academia.
Yeah.
You know.
Because it's about winning arguments, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not just, like you said,
actually,
solving problems.
Winning arguments beats solving problems in that world. Yeah. And that's a problem. Yeah.
Well, I fear that might be true of public health to a lesser degree, probably. But I fear that it's the same. It's like it's this. I think it's driven by this risk aversion, where you've got to have your back covered, and you've got to cover the back of the political person that's sort of representing.
The best decision is not the one most likely to work. It's the one least likely to get you in trouble when things go wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Gigarenza's your guy on that. Definitely.
I've just experienced what it's like because Tiago says that I always give out endless book recommendations and I've just experienced it in reverse.
No, that's good. We'll follow the podcast
really
with it.
I'll end on a final one as well, which I think is mould-breaking, which is Andy Clark's book, The Experience Machine, which is a revival of a theory of human perception being mostly predictive and anticipatory rather than actually objective.
Mm-hmm.
And
I reckon we can make a little post out of just book recommendations.
Yeah, we can. Absolutely. We will put them on links below the podcast.
Yeah, we'll do. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Listen, Rory, thank you very much for all your time.
It's been
today.
A joy. I love this subject. And I, as I said, think like a naturalist. That's the best advice I can give you. Think like a biologist.
A naturist, did you say?
Yeah. No, that's another interesting one, which could be a separate podcast, which is of all the things.
That's the pool thing.
There's an awful lot of... I would like people to fight for naturist rights because of all the things, you know, I'm fairly content with my own gender, but I love the fact that naturists refer to, if I'm right, they refer to non-naturists as textiles, don't they? It's a bit breeders. But I actually, of all the things I would actually fight for that would actually benefit people, apart from those with vitamin D, right? Actually, campaigning for naturism would be not a bad thing. Yeah.
What a great note to end on. A joke that ended up with a serious...
we get too little sunlight, simple fact. True. And by the way, who gets skin cancer? It's not people who work outside all the time. It's people who work in an office and then go on holiday to the Caribbean for 2 weeks and then go and lie on a sun lounger for 2 weeks. That's who gets skin cancer. So naturism, it's part of the solution.
Naturism's part of the solution. You heard it here first.
And Jesus was a behaviour scientist.
I actually go down to Sandwich Bay. I'm off to Sandwich Bay this afternoon on the Kent coast. And there is a naturist beach there, although I've never actually taken my clothes off there. But it greatly annoys.
Hang on. You said you've never taken your clothes off. That means you've been there and not taken your clothes off.
No, you're just there to observe. There weren't any other naturists there, so I didn't know. Okay. I didn't know precisely where the naturist section of the beach was. But I do know that there's an additional benefit that the naturism massively annoys the golfers nearby. So if you don't want to do it for the vitamin D, merely annoying golfers, I think, is an aim in itself. Yeah, fantastic.
Well, fantastic. Rory, it's been a joy.
It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely, Rory.
Fantastic. Thank you. I know not to log out now because we've got to wait to upload.
Don't log out. So Stu's going
to
pause it.
But thank you very much. We're going to leave you to go back to your day. And I know this is going to be an interesting one for people to listen to. So thanks very much.
Yep. Just plug naturism right at the beginning. And then they'll have to listen to the whole 1 hour and 42 minutes.
We'll have a lot of catchphrases.
Clickbait.
Okay, Tiago, wow. What did you make of it? What did you make of that?
I told you that was going to be manic, didn't I? Hopefully you've enjoyed listening to that as much as we've enjoyed making it. It was a great show. I had lots of fun. Did you, Stu?
I loved doing it, but I have to tell you that at the same time, I was stressed because I was listening to it thinking, we're not answering any questions here. I loved all of the theories, the digressions, everything. I was thinking throughout, I need to structure a show out of this.
Yes.
But I thought, do you know what? At some point, I just thought, let's just let this flow where it goes. Yeah. Embrace it. I mean, there was a lot of flow in that. I mean, I think there's some amazing points in there. A lot of that stuff that comes out of the book, but also just really interesting. But I just love the way Rory thinks. And I think he comes up with some really interesting things that make you stop and go, that's a very good point, actually.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many times. Yeah. Even in that show, and I've read Rory's book, seen him speak. I felt like I knew him, but I feel like I know his work pretty well. But even I was in that show, going, that's a good point. Bloody good point, that is. Yeah.
Do you know? To me, the main thing that stood out for me is I think seeing Rory's mind at work, because I feel we saw that. We saw the way he thinks about these things, and I think to me, there were times when he was sharing his views, and I was just thinking, I think we need this sort of creative, manic way of thinking about some of the problems and challenges that we have in public health, isn't it?
I think that he demonstrates really well the point that we've made in several shows about diversity.
Yes.
About like bringing a completely different way of thinking and multiple different types of experiences from different industries into a room and just stopping that we've always done it this way type of sort of thinking that we often see in public health and in academia and in lots of other places, actually. So I was trying to ask the question. I didn't quite get the question out, I don't think, but how do you get people like that into public health? How do you get them into the spaces that we're working in? And that is one of the things I'm still left with. So I challenge you, if you're working in public health, in academia, if you're starting your career in behavioural science, how do you bring that level of diversity into this space, into this work?
So, and I think it's how you create the environment in which that level of diversity is embraced and welcomed, rather than just, like we said, thinking about things with all the planning, all the structure. That is very important. But I think that added element of the creative way of thinking about these problems and the challenging the norms is as important.
Well. And even Rory, he was saying that, you know, even he has trouble saying really simple, unexpected things in meetings where people are expecting something. So if he has trouble with that, then you know, other people might as well. So how do you create a safe enough environment where you can bring that stuff up that's completely out there and people not go, what are you talking about? You've got to have that psychological safety in those spaces.
Absolutely.
So I hope that you enjoyed that show, listening to it as much as we enjoyed making it. I mean, it was a hoot to make, even if it wasn't the most structured of shows, to be honest. We loved making it with Rory. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to... So thank you very much to Rory, just to reiterate that one last time. Don't forget, we want to get yourself to bsphn.org.uk to book your early bird spot at the conference. Don't forget, we've got Michael Marmot there, the orator of the social determinants of health, the Whitehall studies, all of that stuff. You know, go and see them and the other speakers. Go and meet other like-minded people at that conference. Go on there now and book your ticket.
Now.
now. Exactly. And we hope that you enjoyed this Christmas extravaganza with Rory. Yep. We are going to be back in the new year. We've got some awesome guests lined up. I'm going to keep you waiting. Mm. I'm going to tease people to show them in the new year.
That's
who
very
we've
good.
Got.
Great technique.
In the meantime, you know,
a master.
Intrigue. But we'll be back in the new year. In the meantime, have a great Christmas. For those who celebrate Christmas, have a lovely new year, and we will see you in 2024 with some great guests, for great new guests, and at the conference.
Fantastic. Merry Christmas, everyone, and have a lovely new year. See you next year. Can I just say that? Because you love our listeners, I think the best Christmas present you could give them is your rendition of I'm Your Man. Because that was a song that you often sing.
I'm Your Man. Oh, baby, lock them doors and turn the lights down low. That is a good
Merry
song,
Christmas, everyone. Merry Christmas, everyone. That was beautiful, Stu. Thank you.